You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Yesterday, there were over 200 actions around the country and around the world in support of demands in Canada for Aboriginal sovereignty and environmental justice. While support for Idle No More amongst non-native residents of our country has been galvanized, backlash also has entered public discourse. As one counter-movement, Facebook, states it, it is, quote, for Canadians sick of paying taxes to support Aboriginal, quote-unquote, rights, let's just all work, pay our tax, and treat every Canadian the same. Enough handouts. Yet, does Canada subsidize the economies of First Nations? Or do First Nations, in fact, subsidize Canada? Drew Ojije is a writer, journalist, and co-founder of the Media Co-op. Drew wrote the article, What If Natives Stop Subsidizing Canada? It appeared on the Media Co-op, and he joins me now by phone from Montreal. Welcome, Drew, to Red Eye.
Thanks for having me.
You open your article describing the role of public commentators and government in fueling this backlash against the Idle No More movement. What has their role been, and how has it looked?
I mean, really, the role of the media in this has been to operate as sort of a colonial goon squad. In my view, really, what they've done is taken every opportunity to highlight divisions, and on the other hand, not taken every opportunity to actually talk about the context of, you know, why people are protesting, what the sort of treaty relationship is with Native people in Canada. I mean, it's no wonder that Canadians are really deeply uninformed about what's going on, both on a just sort of day-to-day factual level, but also in terms of the kinds of agreements this country was founded on.
We had the case of the Harper government leaking accusatory documents against Chief Spence of Attawapiskat. You also are critical of reporters like Jeffrey Simpson, The Globe and Mail, Christy Blanchford. Could you give us some example of how you think all this has been feeding the resentment against First Nations?
I mean, I think we have to look at what the baseline of knowledge is in Canada, because the media has done such a terrible job, and the government and the education system. Like, very few people in Canada actually have an opportunity to understand what's actually going on, what the history of, you know, the Native communities have experienced is, and so that's really the starting point. And if on that starting point you fail to give any kind of context, you fail to talk about the kinds of things that are happening, the amount of resource revenue that's coming out of Indigenous territories, then I think what it amounts to is affirming racist assumptions and perpetuating them. So I guess that's what I'm saying about what people like Jeffrey Simpson is doing when he says that Natives are living in a dream palace, or what Christy Blatchford's saying when she says that Native protests are, you know, a bunch of horse manure. It's playing to the racist ideology that's perpetuated through the ignorance of the people. It does nothing to correct it, and it does everything to sort of affirm it, and that racist ideology is the basis for the assault that has been going on for 200 to 300 to 400 years in Canada against Indigenous communities.
Well, let's look at it from the positive side. You try to bring to the fore contributions that First Nations have made to the well-being of Canadians at large. Tell us about the situation, for example, in the Algonquin community of Barrier Lake.
Yeah, so the Algonquins of Barrier Lake have been living on their territory. There are pretty much no settlers who live up there. It's their territory. They've never signed a treaty with anyone giving up their territory. You know, they've had agreements and alliances with different people at different times. But the fact is, they've never given up their rights, and those rights have been, you know, affirmed in not only by them, which, you know, I think they just understand it as they've lived there for thousands of years and they're still living there and it's their land. You know, the government of Canada, through the court system, through its laws, actually does recognize their rights, their inherent rights, or sorry, their Aboriginal title as well. So the government's in a bit of a fix because they have a right to the land, but the government wants to, you know, to extract the resources. They want to give away those resources to corporations. So they've gone ahead and done that over the last, you know, 100 years or so. They've installed a huge amount of hydroelectric dams. Forestry companies have been logging there pretty continuously. They actually want to put in mines now. And about $100 million a year comes out of their territory. Meanwhile, the community lives in the, like, pretty dire poverty. In some places, they have people living like 12 people to a house in these sort of dilapidated bungalows, you know, built by Indian Northern Affairs. And they're falling apart, and a lot of them are moldy. They don't even get power, even though the power comes from their territory. It goes straight south to Montreal. And points south, they actually have to use a diesel generator to generate electricity for themselves. They do get very few jobs, if any, from all this, from this $100 million a year of industry that's happening in their territory every year. You know, and they exist in poverty, but they still have a relationship to the land. So what they've done is they've asked the government, and they fought actually, you know, through a series of blockades and political pressure, forced the Quebec and Canadian government to sign an agreement saying that that they could have you know, some say in what resources get extracted from their land, and they could get some jobs from that extraction. Of course, the government wants them to give up their rights completely, and so sees this kind of relationship, this agreement that they actually did sign in 93, as anathema to the kind of policies that they want to carry out, which is to extinguish treaty rights. And so this is why you see a lot of, I don't know, more protesting happening right now. It's because, you know, previous Liberal governments have tried to extinguish treaty rights and an Aboriginal title. But I think the Harper government's trying to accelerate that process pretty intensely. And so it's really woken people up.
Well, let's look at another case of that imbalance between the significant amount of wealth from an area that doesn't go to the native people who live on their lands. I'm referring here to the Lubicon Cree. They mobilized around the Calgary Olympics to protest what was happening on their territory. How does this question of who is subsidizing whom fit in with the example of the Lubicon Cree?
Yeah, I mean, the Lubicon Cree are really one of the starkest examples in Canada. You have, you know, an estimated $15 billion that's come out of their territory. You have just really major and dire health issues that have happened as a result of the sort of extraction that happens on their territory. They have never signed a treaty. You know, in their haste to get all the treaties signed, the treaty negotiators in Alberta didn't you know, go across the territory systematically enough to realize that those people were living there, and so they've continued to exist without a treaty, and meanwhile the resources have been stolen from their land. And they've gotten very, very little out of that. They have, you know, they've existed in dire poverty. You know, they've had major health issues because of sort of sour gas flaring nearby. They've had, they've existed without running water. They've had campaigns of division waged against them by the government in an effort to, like, stop them from asserting their traditional rights, and so on. So so, yeah, it's one of the most stark examples of a Native community, you know, unwillingly subsidizing the Canadian economy to the tune of billions of dollars.
Just one more example, because it's been the center of a lot of the media focus, and that's the case of the people in Attawapiskat and Chief Teresa Spence there. What's the economic relationship between the people of Attawapiskat and the Canadian state in terms of this revenue that goes outside from their territory?
Yeah, I mean, so in Attawapiskat, you know, one of the things that's happening right now is there's a giant diamond mine being built, you know, in the area, and there, you know, which is going to have an estimated $6.7 billion windfall, you know, for the Ontario economy. All of the royalties from that mining operation are going to go to the province of Ontario, because basically because they're not respecting the treaty, and this is pretty much the norm. You know, in places like Nunavut, you have, you know, huge amounts of money that come out, and then the government, you know, gives the money back. Same thing with Attawapiskat. You have, you know, $6.7 billion in revenues that's going to come in because of that mine, but the media is all, you know, all aflutter with talk of this $90 million over, I think, 7 years that Attawapiskat is getting, you know, which is not actually that much more per capita than any other place in Canada gets in terms of the amount of tax dollars spent on it.
You've, in your article, put forward the figure that the total spent on First Nations across Canada is just over $7,000 a year, which is about half of what the government spends on residents of Toronto. That's a startling fact. Has it appeared anywhere in the media?
I haven't seen it. No, I haven't seen it anywhere. And this is just another example of the media really failing, falling down on the job in terms of its duties to actually inform people, to actually talk about the numbers, you know. I think there's an assumption that, you know, people see numbers like, oh, $190 million over, you know, and then they, of course, neglect to mention that it's over, you know, a multi-year period, you know, for a community of 1,000 people, and that money includes all the services that they get, you know, health, education, everything. And so, yeah, people see big numbers like that, and then they hear the audit. And so I've actually had a lot of people see a lot of comments on Twitter and sort of online commentary where people are saying, oh, $100 million went missing. And that's just, I mean, that's just not true by any stretch of the imagination, because those dollars are actually going to fund services. But again, the fact that it's not shown, I think, affirms the racist assumptions that, oh, we're just subsidizing these people, when in fact, you know, Native communities only get that one sort of level of government funding. It's from the federal government, whereas a place like Ottawa will get municipal tax revenues. They'll get provincial tax dollars coming in. They'll get federal tax dollars coming in, and so that accounts for them having quite a bit larger per capita spending.
Well, thanks for your work, and thanks also for taking time this morning to speak with us. Best of luck, Drew.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
I've been speaking with Drew Ojijay. He's a writer and journalist based in Montreal.